Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, here in sunny and hot and humid Fairfield, Iowa today. Our guest, I got to say, this book was one I could not put down. Mai Corland is a Korean-American attorney and writer born in Seoul and adopted into New York. From there, she ran away from winter and studied in Florida at Rollins College and the University of Miami. Due to a variety of questionable decisions, she currently lives in the cold again with her partner, children, and a goldfish who will outlive them all. When not writing, you can find her asleep or clutching her latte machine, and I'm sure there's got to be some child care mixed in there, too. Mai writes award-winning children's and young adult books under the name Meredith Ireland. And this book that we're talking about today is Five Broken Blades, which is a really fun fantasy epic saga that we're going to learn more about. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Mai.
Thank you so much. So just a quick note, I pronounce it May.
May, I am so sorry. I was going to ask you before we started.
No, you're totally fine because actually M-A-I probably should be pronounced Mai, but because it's my initials, it's Meredith Ann Ireland, I pronounce it May.
Okay, all right.
So it's totally fine.
Is this your first not children's book?
Yes, it is.
It is. Wow.
Mm-hmm. It's not the first one I've written, but it's the first one I've published.
Well, that's a story that we'll get into. But first, tell us what this book is about, what it's based on, and why you wrote it.
So Five Broken Blades, I like to say that it's Ocean's 11 meets a Korean fantasy-inspired Kill Bill. It's five... I like that. Somebody else said that, and I was like, you know what? That's exactly what it is. It's five dangerous people, five dangerous liars, plus a side buddy, we'll get into him later, who have to get together to try to kill the king. And the problem is that the king, when he has his crown on, is immortal.
And this is set in the past, the future, or some unknown time frame?
So it's an unknown time frame. Okay. It's set in a realm. It mostly takes place in a place called Yusan. There are references to the fact that there are other realms like Catan and Wei and Gaia, which was a former realm but is now a colony. And then there's kind of an unincorporated desert fallow. But technologically speaking, they're in around the Middle Ages.
Okay. And magic still plays a little part in the world, but not a lot. Or at least not a lot that people are aware of.
Not a lot that people are aware of in this book.
In this book. Okay. So this is, I'm guessing this isn't the only book that's going to be set in this world with these characters. Am I right?
You are right. We just announced that Four Ruined Realms is book two. And that'll come out in January. And then we're discussing where to put book three, but it will be in 2025. So the series will be complete before the end of next year is wrapped up.
Wow. So that must mean that both of those books are already written?
So book two is written. We are in the process of revising it to get it ready. Book three is currently in the ether. It's concept because until book four is really polished and done, it's subject to change, and then you would have to change too much, I think, in the last book.
When you set out to write Five Broken Blades, did you have this entire three-book arc in mind?
Yes. I'm a pantser. When I write, I don't really outline. Fantasy takes a little bit more. But I love letting the story organically come together. So we have a vague idea of where the entire series is going. I do know where I want it to end up mostly. We knew what book two would be about. But the details are well, for book two, they're solidified because it's drafted, but book three is still a little bit up in the air.
So I notice you keep saying we. So even And at first I thought, okay, well, you're including your editor in this process, but even sort of pretty early on, it sounds like there was a we.
Yes, so Red Tower, for the most part, by far, about like 90%, is collaborative. So the author is bringing ideas in at the early stages with the editor to craft these books.
Well, this is unusual, wouldn't you say?
It is. I love it though. I think two heads are better than one. I think that especially my editor just brings so much. I will be spinning my wheels like how do I fix this arc? How do I fix something or something's lacking in the book, and in 4 seconds she has the problem diagnosed and a way to fix it. And it's just an amazing process.
Wow. So how did you come to Red Tower? How did you find them? How did they find you? What made you decide to write your first would this be considered young adult, or it's a little
So it's new adult.
new adult? Okay. I was going to say I was going to have my grandson read it because he loves reading. He's 14 and he loves fantasy and sci-fi, but then I realized as I read it, it probably isn't for him. He's a little young probably for it.
Couple more years,
Yeah. And so anyway, back for your first new adult novel, why did you decide to write it this way rather than just go hole up in your office and do your
Right.
thing? Yeah.
So I love the collaborative process. I love what Red Tower is doing. I love how much they get behind their authors and behind these stories. I had a friend who actually works at Entangled, who thought I would be a good fit. So I wound up talking, my agent talked to them, and then I wound up on the phone, and we tried to see if it would be a good fit to do this collaborative process, and it was so great. We wound up talking on Zoom for probably 2 hours, and at the end of that 2 hours, we had the story idea.
Wow. Okay. So there's sort of this Korean history element to the book, right? Now, was that something that you have always wanted to incorporate in, or maybe you have in some of your children's books?
So, if you had asked me the same question probably 10 years ago, I would have said, no, I'm not really interested. I'm adopted. I was born and raised there, but I don't have any real desire to know anything about it. I'm good here. And then I would say that having children has changed that, because you do want to wind up wanting to know more of where you came from. Or at least that's how it happened with me. So I started researching Korea and Korean mythology, for a middle grade fantasy, that I wound up writing in like 10 days. And then I wound up like canceling twice, but like that's just a weird like publishing and how that works. So it actually I don't think will ever come out, but
Oh.
I loved it. It was like Korean mythology in modern day Brooklyn. I thought it was fun, but it wound up forming, in that everything happens for a reason realm. It wound up forming the basis for my knowledge for Five Broken Blades, which was so cool. I took real historical events and kind of changed them, like the Festival of Blood is real. The slaughter on an island did happen. The way that the powers that be work in that kind of ocean realm is very real. And then I took mythology, but I added and subtracted from it. So there is a dragon lord. There is the god of the East Sea and the god of the West Sea because it's a peninsula. But as far as the relics go, that was original to me because I was an art history major in college and I love relics.
Oh, very cool. What about the kind of the monsters, the those giant birds and
I've said this before, but I stand by it. I think birds are terrifying, and I'm trying to convince everybody else that I'm right at this point.
Well,
So.
you have my daughter on your side, believe me.
Okay.
She has always found birds terrifying. And she kind of got attacked by a blackbird when she was in
Oh.
college, and it was very scary.
That'll do it. I mean, if you're if you're attacked by a bird, that's it. I so there's a Samjoko in Korean mythology, which is a three-legged crow, but it's not nearly at like the monstrous scale that a Samrock is. Rocks are from actually Mideastern mythology. And I wanted to add like a kind of Korean spin to it.
Okay, and then there's the you don't get too much into it, but the things that are in the lake surrounding the
The Iku, yeah, I love you. That's
yeah.
a that is a creature of my terrifying imagination, like kind of taking what should be a nice mermaid and changing it into something
Oh, it
horrific.
sounded really. I mean, I was like, well, wouldn't it even attack rowboats? You know, if because he was thinking of taking a rowboat across instead of going across the bridge. I'm like, well, I don't think I'd want to be in a rowboat on that lake.
No, but
That's
it was big enough. I think that they would make it secure enough so that you could. But yeah, I wouldn't. It's not really want to cry. They do come into play, and that lake comes into play in the second book.
Ah, okay. So I was I didn't know as I was reading that it was part of a trilogy, and so there was a little bit of like, oh man. I mean, I was excited that there'd be more, but I was disappointed not to have a little more what was it, that the hero didn't win yet, put it that way.
I mean, there's a definite question as to who is the hero in this, but
There is, yes, that is true. That is true. And we're not really sure about that yet either. So
no, we know pretty well who the bad guys are, but we're not hero is a question.
Yes, yeah.
But
So
we have I don't know how else to we could have. Because a few people have commented that they didn't realize it wasn't a standalone, but I'm like, I'm not sure how you would put on, the first book to let people know that it's the first one. I don't
I
know.
guess I sometimes they just say in the title book one
Yeah,
or something
yeah.
like that. Book one of the blah blah
Yeah, that's
trilogy.
true. We have that. We have that like on Amazon, but it's on Barnes and Noble. But yes, if you're just in a store, you wouldn't really see that. But yes, it is a trilogy. But it will be complete in three books.
And it's exciting that they're coming out so fast, but do you feel, I mean, you haven't You said you haven't started writing book three, and it's going to be out before the end of 2025. Isn't that feel like a lot of pressure?
No, not really.
You're a fast writer.
I am fast, and it. So I've now spent two books, so probably around almost 1,000 pages in this world. So it's so familiar. It's kind of just like walking back into your room, at this point. So I'm not, we had to spend time developing these characters, and I think as a reader, you need a reason to care. You need a reason to care about each person and what happens to them. Like, action is fantastic, but if you start the scene with, say, if you start the book with, say, a battle, you're like, oh, this is interesting, but why should I care about any of these people? So a lot of Five Broken Blades was establishing who these people are, what their background was, why you should care about them while they're on this mission and this journey and bringing them together. And then in the future books, it's they're unleashed. Like, you know who they are, and now they're in their element,
You know,
achieving
one
their
thing I
goals.
really liked was that even though, they start out not trusting one another, and even by the end of the book, they still have secrets from one another. But there was some, I don't know, sometimes it seems like authors tend to, particularly with the characters that are have a potential romance, that they take so long for the person to give the other person a chance that I get annoyed. And you did not do that. You did the exact right amount of time for for them to open up to one another a little bit, while still holding something back.
I think starting the six people off in different places helps that. I think because you can get to know the individual couples before they have to all interact together. So I think it gives it some time to breathe.
That's a good point. That's very good. Well, May, why don't you read a little bit so we get a so our listeners can get a feel for the book?
Sure, absolutely. So we're going to just start at the beginning. So, Chapter One, Royo, City of Umbria, Yusan. Gold for blood, that's my advertisement and the words I live by. The merchant slowly counts out gold mun, his gloved hands shaking as each coin lands in his palm. He's a little taller than me, but my shoulders are twice as wide. Hurry it up, I don't got all night, I say. My deep voice startles him, and two bronze mun clatter onto the ground. He lets the coins roll away, but pauses to consider chasing them down. 10 hells, this is going to take 2 lifetimes. Finally, he slips the money into my hand, paying for the broken nose and leg. Then he darts away, fur-lined cape flapping into the night breeze. It's not a noble living, being muscle for hire, but the upper class ain't great neither. I count my gold as I lumber between the soot-covered buildings, all there. I put the money in my coin purse and tuck it into my inner jacket pocket. Behind me, my latest victim whimpers in the darkness of the alley. If he keeps up that noise, the hail birds will peck him clean before morning, and the rich merchant prick didn't pay for a kill. Can you stop that racket, I say? The whimpering dies down. Thank you, I say. He's silent, shut up by my manners or his pain. I think about going back to help. I always think about it, but it's none of my business. It's not my problem what happens after my jobs are done or why the merchant wanted to send a message in the first place. Those are roads that lead nowhere, and I've got somewhere to be. I blow a warm breath in my gnarled hands. The frost shines on the cobbled streets, and the runoff has already started to freeze. What trees there are in this cramped city are long bare. Winter comes quick in Umbria, but then death always does. I should buy some warm gloves, but my stomach tightens at the thought of parting with even one silver mun. Every coin counts. When I get to Inch Street, two well-dressed couples split around me. They're all fur muffs and expensive feathered hats. Swells. They give me a wide berth, then scurry away like I'm contagious or something. I guess if my size don't intimidate people, the scar dividing my face does the trick. People stay away. Good. With a grunt, I shoulder open the heavy wooden door of Butcher and Ale. I've been in nicer, cleaner places with better grub, but those pubs don't fit me. The tavern is warm without being hot and noisy without being loud, and that's all I need. Butcher and Ale is home. It's where I started doing business 15 years ago. Right after I turned 15, I set up shop in the corner, 40 pounds less muscle with no scar on my face. They know what I do here, but I keep the place safe, so they look the other way. I sit on my usual stool at the end of the bar. Yuri sees me and pours me a pint. He could be 40, he could be 60. Who knows with that bald head? But he's not the chatty type, and I like that. He slides a beer across the worn wood. The glass is mostly clean. Someone's been looking for you. I raise my eyebrows and chug a gulp of ale. Somebody is always looking for me. To fight, to hurt, to kill. This ain't news. Why should I care? Yuri puts the bar towel over his shoulder and leans forward. It was a girl. I stop drinking. My heart thuds and then lodges in my throat. I will it back down and play it cool. What'd she look like? Pretty, Yuri says. Not the most helpful description. I curl my hand into a fist and stare. His eyes widen and he rubs his nose somebody else broke a while ago. Then he starts yammering. About my height, big brown eyes, kind of short, black hair. Around your age, like mid-20s, red velvet cloak. I swallow, digesting his words. A tall 20-something girl asking about me is unusual, and I guess pretty makes a difference. Can't remember the last time a pretty girl looked for me. Maybe she wants an old boyfriend taught a lesson or revenge on another girl. I don't hurt girls, though. She's staying at the Black Shoe Inn, Yuri adds. The nicest joint in maybe all of Umbria. So she has money, and she's not from here, yet somehow new to look for me. Here. This reeks of trouble. Not interested, I say. Yuri shrugs. Suit yourself. He wanders down the bar to serve another customer. A guy looking old for his age sits on the stool 4 paces down from me. He only makes eye contact with Yuri, so he's also here to drink alone. Sometimes it feels less lonely to drown your sorrows in a shared barrel of ale. To vanish in the pub crowd, even if you don't say a word to nobody. Most nights, that's me. But I can't disappear tonight. I know in my guts it's going to be one of those times when I can't forget, no matter how much I drink. So why give myself a headache that'll hit behind my eyes tomorrow? I down my beer, leaving the dregs. I push back from the bar, the legs of the stool scraping the sticky floor. I'm out of here. Yuri's bushy eyebrows rise. It's like what he didn't get on his head went to his face instead. Already? He's right to be surprised. I'm normally good for a few beers as I take up my corner and wait for my next job to come in. Trouble always has a way of finding me. Usually it's quick, but sometimes it takes 4 beers. Tonight it's just the one. Headache. I tap my temple like he don't know where my head is, but it's a lie. And from his beady eyes going side to side, Yuri doesn't believe it for a second. But he nods. Night, Royo. I take a step to leave and something strange happens. An off feeling hits me like a heart skipping a beat. Out of the corner of my eye, I swear there's a blur of red. I blink hard, look around, and then glance in the bar mirror. Nothing, just my scarred face and shorn head looking back at me. Nothing red in sight. I shake my head. I'm real off tonight. Best I leave now. I trudge my way out of Butcher and Ant and back onto the frigid street. I'll need to repair the laces of my boots soon, probably patch the leather again. They still got some wear left. I swear it got colder when I was inside. My exhale now makes little fogs in the air. I blow a hot breath into my hands again as I walk. 5 blocks in the wrong direction later, I pass the Black Shoe Inn. I can't help but slow down and stare at the lamps glowing in the windows. I wonder, then shake my head. What am I doing? What am I even looking for? I walk double time to get away. It's too suspicious, too off. My instincts are always right, and the scars I bear are reminders of the times I've ignored my gut. The last time cost me everything. I'm not doing it again. It's about a 15-minute walk along Avalon Road to my shack on the cheap end of town. The buildings get more run down, smaller as I leave the business district. Umbria has been going downhill since King June rose to power back when I was a kid. The whole country has. The road bends, and then I have the river on my left. You'd think being near water would be nice, but not in Umbria. The only waterway we got is the Dirty Soul River. People empty chamber pots and dump trash right into the thing. And it's even colder, the bone-chilling kind, when you're close enough to hear the water lick the filthy shore. I try to stay aware of my steps, my surroundings. There are too many dangers in Umbria, from gangs, from men like me, from the hailbirds, to be caught sleepwalking. But I'm off my game, distracted. I blame Yuri. He's a barkeep, not a messenger. He could have kept all that noise to himself. But I'm not really mad at Yuri. Truth is, I'm thinking about her. When Yuri said it was a girl, I hoped. And hope is a jagged knife. Hope pieces together dreams out of broken glass, only for reality to come and smash them all over again. Hope is the cruelest punishment of them all. Because without hope, I know. It's not her, you fool. It can't be. It can never be, because I killed her.
And that was Mae Corlin reading from Five Broken Blades. And that's only one of our, well, really 6 characters.
Yes.
Because there's 5 dangerous ones and one who's just sort of along for the ride.
He's dangerous in his own way.
He is, isn't he? So, is there one of those characters that you identify with the most?
I like them all. They're the ones that were the most fun to write. Identify though. Well, probably Sora. I gave her my hearing loss. So my left side hearing loss that I have is in the book is her. And yeah, everybody wants to be a poison maiden, like that kind of power. And although she loses so much, but she also is the one who is probably clinging the most to goodness, to trying to still be a good person.
Well, they all do in a way.
They all do in a way.
Yeah.
They all love something very much, which I think makes them relatable.
Yes. Yeah. So, what exactly is a poison maiden, and was this something from mythology?
So this was actually something from ancient history. So in India, there were girls called poison maidens who would become immune to certain poisons and then use that and seduce, I suppose, powerful men. And they would assume that whatever she was drinking out of or eating was safe because she's breathing. And they'd wind up dead.
Wow. And you think this actually did happen? That this
In
was.
ancient India, that's where it comes from.
Wow.
So I read about that and I thought, my first thought was, my gosh, what would have to happen for a girl to become immune that way? Like, how many girls would die to,
To develop that, yeah.
yeah, to develop that immunity? And so Sora was actually the first character that I started with when I began writing Five Broken Blades. Of this girl who was unwilling, who was kind of purchased and put into this poison school, and who lost everything along the way. And then, the other part of this is even in ancient India, I don't think that these girls were free. Like, I don't think that they were running a business of
They
assassinating
weren't
poison
doing it
men.
because they wanted to. It wasn't a
Right,
career
I don't think
choice.
so. No, I don't. Yeah, this wasn't their career day option. Like, I think that this was the same type of, you were like, you had a very powerful man in control who wanted other powerful men dead.
Yeah. So you said you started writing her, but did you have all of the characters kind of in mind before you started writing?
So after the end of that Zoom call, yes, I did. But during that Zoom call is when we fleshed out, who else, who would she be trying to kill? What kind of world would this be that this kind of person's necessary?
Okay, so you
Why?
started with the concept of the poison maiden, and that was all you had,
That was
basically.
pretty much all I had. And it was. Yeah, it was because I it was like, which direction do you go with this? Do we go kind of a dark academia way, or do we go with she's already an adult, she's already a poison maiden, which I liked better. Because as I was talking to my agent about ideas, we were like, oh, we could go kind of this avenue or this avenue. And then we kind of branched out though from her already being a couple years, a few years into being a professional killer, and why she would do this, and what leverage you would have to have over this person, to make them murder when they don't want to.
Okay, so then how did the other characters sort of come? You said by the end of that Zoom call, you sort of had the concept for each of them. I'm curious, like, I don't, without giving away spoilers, like, how did you come up with the idea of Aerie?
So we wanted to get together a group of untrustworthy people. So we were like, what kind of people wouldn't you trust? Well, you wouldn't trust a spy. You wouldn't trust a thief. You wouldn't trust somebody in exile. You wouldn't trust somebody who's muscle for hire, because you know the fear is always there that they would betray you, that there would be a price that's better. And then how do you get all these people who could easily be lying, easily be betraying each other to work together?
Right. And in some ways, all of them, the reasons that the apparent reasons weren't the real reasons.
Right. So they have their reasons that they want the king dead. And then there's some people who want the crown. There are some people who don't want the crown. There's, you know, some people who have a different, you know, they have their seeming motivation of, generally speaking, money or power. And then there are people who are out for revenge. There's people who are out to save somebody else. Like there's the variety of reasons that would motivate you and really be compelling above telling the truth.
Right. You did a really good job with the twist, by
Thank you.
the way. You drop breadcrumbs, but I had not figured it out till pretty close to the end.
The goal is always, you know, in the way that it is kind of a mystery, right? Like, so it's an epic fantasy, it has romance, but it is very much in the mystery genre too. You have to have breadcrumbs. Like if it comes out of absolutely nowhere, like I don't think that you laid a good enough groundwork then. Like it shouldn't be something that a reader can't foresee at all. Like so usually what we've heard for the most part is some people have been able to guess who the traitor is, but they didn't see the end part coming. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I had my suspicions, but not who, not the reason why. I actually thought at some point somebody, I thought maybe the spy master, that someone was actually related to him, or you know, I had different ideas with
No, no
it.
spoilers though. We won't
No,
spoil.
we
We won't
won't,
spoil.
we won't. So now, I understand that you like to you have your characters eating a lot. And food
My
kind of
editor
plays
said
an important part.
it does. It does. I'm always, you know, if I'm going on a trip, I'm on Yelp. I'm looking for what they have, and the food's very important to me.
Well, isn't that the whole reason to travel?
I think so.
Yeah.
But also, food says a lot. Food says a lot about a world. It says a lot about the status of someone. It says a lot about commerce and how things are getting from one location to another. You know, what the rich eat versus what the poor eat. You know, you've got kids foraging for edibles in a meadow, and you have these counts that are putting on these just elaborate, incredibly expensive meals. You have the regionality coming into play of what a meal in Umbria looks like versus what it looks like in Tamiaki, that's seaside. I think you can accomplish a lot of world building in just having your characters sit down for a meal. So in Five Broken Blades, you know, they're sitting down in their silverware and there's chopsticks. There's recognizably American dishes like steak, and there's recognizably Asian dishes like japchae. So it's another way to in reinforce that fusion aspect that's pervasive through the book.
Interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. I was sort of more focused on the kind of the Asian element of it, but you were, tell me about what some of the other things that more American that you have that you incorporated.
So in my mind, like when I was building these cities, Umbria is to me very almost European in visually. Tamnaki is based on Atlantis. Rahway is more of a desert city. You know, whether you take kind of Arizona for an example, or you take somewhere in the Middle East. And then Gain had more of a almost like South of France, Polynesian, like that kind of like islandy feel to it. Like it's whitewashed with you know, blue sea and the sea breeze with these walls around the city, but then these flower districts. To me, that the setting itself had a very East meets West.
You know, you describe this all very visually. Any talk about a movie? Or are you not allowed to say if there is?
I came from a very interesting call earlier on today. That's all I can say.
Okay. All right. So when you sit down to write this, is this like a full-time job for you? Because I understand you're also an attorney and a mother. So how much time are you able to devote to writing?
So, I actually retired from being an attorney very recently. So I do write full time, which I like to say, except that if my kids are here, that's just not true at all. I'm a full-time mother slash Uber driver to events. Yeah, I family has to come first.
Right.
You know, the writing will be there, I hope, but the children won't be. So, being a mom comes first, and they are incredibly proud, and they're getting older, so they more understand that, you know, if I'm in my office, especially if I have a call or something, that they need to be quiet. They are also, you know, my youngest is now desperate for a phone, so they're that which will make all of them now having their own device, and that's a little easier for them, I think, to understand. But yeah, so I write full time, which is how I write fast. I don't think that if I were still, you know, it was never 9 to 5. So if I was still an 8 to 6 attorney, I don't see how I would be able to do this.
Right. So, were you still working as an attorney when you were writing your middle grade reader books, and or were they young adult?
A young adult.
Young
So
adult,
I
yeah.
was, when I had my son, yeah, when I had my son, I went out on extended maternity leave, and then basically became of counsel. So became extremely piecemeal part time, because it was more important to me and more important to our family that I was able to be there, and we were in a good position to make that happen. So I hadn't been full time in an office in over a decade.
Okay, so I'm looking at your other books. So you had The Jasmine Project, which was a YA rom-com about family and food and finding love.
There's a common theme here,
And then Everyone Hates Kelsey Miller, which was
yeah.
also a young adult rom-com. And then Emma and the Love Spell, which was a middle grade reader or middle grade, which is maybe getting a little into the fantasy era
Yeah,
and
very light fantasy.
light fantasy. And then you went, I mean, these are quite different books.
Yeah, it's quite a departure, which is hence the pen name. Because, you know, they're sweet little books. The evil guy is a baker. Like it's just like it had to be different because that book came out in January. So because we were launching so close to a sweet little middle grade, we just didn't, especially because if I go and I talk to fourth, fifth graders, this is the book they want to read, and I'm like, no. So, you know, that precocious, like, oh, I shouldn't be reading this. I'm definitely gonna read this. You know, we wanted to set it apart because of the genocide and, you know, the rest of it going on. But so that's why that we have the pen game.
Now, do your children read your books?
So, my daughter has read Emma and she loved it. She loved You Are Here, which was an anthology that I was on with just these incredible middle grade writers, like Newbery Award winners, and then it was just like me hanging out there. But it's a great book. It got like 6-star reviews, and it's just so good. It's a bunch of kids in an airport encountering like macro and kind of microaggressions, being East and Southeast Asian. And she loved that one. They're both too young for the YAs still, although probably in a year or two she can read Jasmine. And then my son is just disappointed that I didn't write nonfiction about dinosaurs. He's like, that's, he's extremely proud that I'm a writer. He wanted to bring Jasmine to school with him when it first came out. But he's a nonfiction guy, so he
How
hasn't
old
read
is
any of
he?
them. He's just turned 13.
Oh. Well, yeah, I can understand. I can understand that.
He would also have accepted like nonfiction about like some animals, probably.
Yes.
Maybe some biosphere nonfiction, but this is just not his cup of tea, which is
Well,
fine.
he'd probably love our guest a few weeks ago, Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice, who wrote Your Pet's Secret Lives. You should get that one for him. He will like
Okay.
that. It's got all
Fine.
kinds of really fascinating things about animals that nobody knows. So
See, he would be proud of that.
yeah.
He would be proud of that mother. The one who's an international best-selling author, like, nah, like that's, you're not gonna read that.
Well, one of the reasons that I originally thought my grandson might like this book was because he is Asian American, and
Oh, okay.
yeah. But like I said, I think it's
Couple years.
a little
Couple
adult for
years.
him. Yeah, a couple of years,
Yeah,
exactly.
it is.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Mae Corland, author of Five Broken Blades. Did you write? You've got these six characters and you're switching points of view, which can be challenging to do. Thank you for actually having at the top of each chapter whose point of view we're in, because that's very helpful for the reader. But do you write sort of chronologically in the book, or in other words, did you write it in the order that we're reading it in or not?
Just about. There were some chapters where I would write it and then I would realize that a different character had the emotional weight. So then it would have to change whose point of view it was in. So then I'd have to go back through and make sure that it is written from their lens. It has their feelings about the world in it. It had their slang in it, or every character has slang. It's just some is more pronounced than others. But that they're, the way in which Sora describes something is going to be inherently different from Mikhail, and it's going to be inherently different from Royo. The goal was to make their voices unique enough so that even if you didn't look at the top, you knew who was talking.
Right.
Even with six, I think in the beginning you need them, and hopefully as the book rolls along, as you get to page 150-ish, from what I've heard, people kind of just lock in and are aware of who's talking.
Yeah, I would say that's true. And but each of them is written in a first person perspective too. Yeah.
It had originally started with three. Then I was like, it has to be six because of the mystery element to it.
Wow. So, so you had the first three, and then, or you still had the other characters in the book, but you weren't going to write from their point of view.
Yeah,
Is it?
exactly.
Okay.
Then because of the mystery aspect to it, if you weren't hearing from one of them, you'd be like, well, it must be them.
Right. That makes sense. That makes sense. And was there a, you said this is very collaborative with your editor, Red Tower Books. So was there a lot of back and forth as you were writing?
Nope.
No.
No, it wasn't. I was free to write whatever I wanted as a first, the same thing with Forgotten Realms. Free to write whatever I wanted as a first draft, and then we'll fix it as we go and edit. As we get notes. Which is it's great. I actually just heard earlier today that one of the favorite scenes of someone was the last scene that I wrote. When my editor's like, "Oh, we need another moment like here," and I'm like, "Oh, okay." And that wound up being the favorite. So it's such a great, unique process because I wouldn't have added it on my own.
So would you, that's, yeah, because normally writers do a lot of self-editing before it goes to an editor. They don't send the first draft.
Right.
But you,
And she's seeing a first draft, but it's not really. I wouldn't send anybody my zero draft. I don't do that. I've written it, I let it rest a little bit, I've revised it. Kind of you're trying to get it to the point of I can no longer improve this on my own.
Okay. Now this is over 400 pages, so how long does that take you?
So, for Four Ruined Realms, which is, I don't remember for Five Broken Blades, but for Four Ruined Realms, I started writing it in January, January like 6th, I want to say, 7th. And I had to take like a week or maybe a half off because I was, nope, about a week. I had to take about a week off and I was done by the end of March.
Oh my gosh, you are fast.
Yeah, it's 3,000 words a day.
Wow, that's a lot. Is it, do you write sort of, you just put it all out there? You don't stop while you're writing? Or do
Oh no, I stop all the time
you
and
stop
it's
all the time?
terrible.
Whoa,
I
okay.
stop all the time and I go back through what I wrote before and I'm like, why am I doing this? I know this is a waste of time, but it is now my process and I'm too many books in to change it. Like I know, like I'm like switching doorknobs around on a house that's gonna be demolished, and yet I cannot stop. So it just is what it is at this point. So whenever I start writing, I go back through and I try to limit it to how far I go back at this point. At the very early stages, I'm going back to page one, which is so, think about how wasteful that is. But anyhow, I go back to page one, and then at a certain point, I'm like, okay, don't go back past 50. Okay, then don't go back past 100. And then, then
Okay,
it's, but
okay.
then eventually I hit like around 200. I'm like, I should read through from the beginning. And I'm like, no, I should. I'm like, but I do. So it does, it's a little bit of a self to be. It's not a process that I'd be like, everybody should do this, but it works for me.
It works for you. So, where did the title come from? How did you come up with the title?
Gosh, I don't even remember. It wasn't, so originally it was the Five Blades.
Okay.
And then Red Tower thought that that sounded a little bit too much like Fourth Wing. So we then changed it to be Five Broken Blades, which is great because we now have the alliteration in the second one too of Four Ruined Realms.
Right. I wondered if the third one was going to be like Three Terrible Tyrants.
It could be three something. So yeah.
Yeah, it would make sense, wouldn't it? Is
It
there
would. People think it's five books and it's not. It's quite frankly only it is only the three. So
So what will you do when this world's done?
I actually have already started the next series.
Oh, wow.
Yep, this is the downside of being a fast writer is if I'm not writing, and I did, I needed to take, I took over, like I'm like a month and a half off after I handed it in because I was pretty burnt out. Not clinical burnout, but like just kind of I needed to
Yeah,
relax
you
from
needed a
that.
break.
After I finished it, not really related to Red Tower at all. It was because previous to Red Tower, I had been under contract for all of these Tidlit books that I was killing myself to get done. The advances on the Kidlit side is smaller, And so you have to take on more of them in order to pay the mortgage. So I was trying to get those drafts done, and it was just back to back to back to back and into writing Five Broken Blades. And then Red Tower has completely changed everything. So,
Did you always know you wanted to be a writer?
no, I've always written. But I, well, let's see, I thought at first when I was little growing up in New York City, I thought I wanted to be like on Wall Street. I didn't have a real concept of what that meant. But like I knew like they had like, the power suits and everything. I was like, oh, that's cool. So I thought I wanted to be like a businesswoman, like a whatever. That was first. Then there was in college, I eventually became pre-med. I was going to be a military doctor. And then I decided to take a year off and just kind of be and make sure that that's what I wanted to do. And then I went to law school and became a lawyer. But in the background of this, I always wrote. I wrote a journal, the angsty teenage journals, and then also, short, not even novellas, like, but that I would consider to be books at the time when I was young. But it was nothing that I thought to ever pursue until, I mean, it sounds really sad, but like my stepfather was dying, and it drove home the point of you don't have an endless amount of time. So why not pursue the things that you think may not be able to happen? Like, what's the worst that happens? Like, you get rejected, you can't do it. Well, it's better than never trying. So I took it seriously, and I was staying at home, being a mom, going quickly out of my mind, watching Bubble Guppies, and it's just like it's just full of anachronisms. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And there's only so much of that you can watch when you have an active brain. So then I started writing, and I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna take this seriously. I'm going to write. I'm gonna query. I'm gonna learn how to do that. And the rest is kind of history.
Well, I'm looking at your blog on the Meredith Ireland website, and there's something on here I wanted to ask you about DV Pit.
Yes, so that actually still exists. That is Diverse Voices Pitch. And I think it's now moved over to Discord because Twitter kind of imploded, especially on the book side. And it is for historically marginalized writers to pitch their event, and it's to highlight just them, to literary agents and editors. The editors can't acquire because they're Big Five editors, but if they there's some smaller editors too on there. But if they like your pitch, or I think it was like retweet or something like that, then it's so that when you do get an agent, the agent submits it to them because it's something that would be interesting for them. So that's how I wound up signing with my agent,
Oh, okay.
my first agent.
Okay. And then
I went through
you
a couple,
became
so
a mentor for them too.
I did, and I love that. I was also a Pitch Wars mentor. My last mentee actually just this past year, I want to say, got her first book deal, and I was so excited for her, and I'm so proud. But then I still talk to my first Pitch Wars mentee like all the time, Alexa, who is on her, gosh, sixth book.
Wow.
Yeah, I want to say six. So yeah, I have a long history mentoring, and it's my favorite thing. And I hope, well, once these two series are complete, I hope to get back to it.
Now, you mentioned that that you have a new adult, your first adult novel, I think you said didn't get published. Or you had one that didn't get published. Do you have others in the drawer?
I mean, I do, but they're terrible. Like, they didn't get published for a reason. Like, I thought they were good at the time. Like, for me, it's like there are some writers who can tinker with the same manuscript and revise it and make it better for 10 years. I'm not that type of writer. I will be on to the next idea. So when I was learning to write, I went through four, I think, four trunk manuscripts, and they were terrible. Yeah, they'll never
Oh,
see the light of day. I don't know where they are. But four within about a year. That should tell you, how much effort went into them, which wasn't a lot. But I think everything is a learning experience. Like, everything's a step that makes you, like, there are no wasted words. Like, everything makes you better at your craft.
So your process was of learning was largely just doing it.
And reading a lot. In the beginning, I was told, oh, you should probably read more. And I'm like, shh, I've read a ton of books. Like, no, you do. You need to read a lot more. Like, reading things that are current in your genre that you want to be in is just so helpful.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today, May. And like I said, this was one of those books that I would have read even if I weren't interviewing you. But I'm very glad that I got to talk to you today, and I hope that I'm looking forward to the next book before January.
Thank you. I'm not sure if we're doing ARCs again. We'll have to see. But thank you so much for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. We always end with a quote, and what I found for today was from Albert Einstein. The gift of fantasy has meant more to me than my talent for absorbing positive knowledge. Not quite sure what he meant by that, but I like
I like
it
it too. I'm not exactly sure what that means either, but
anyway.
I like it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.